G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Seamus Tobin, who is doing a Master of Science in Astronomy under the supervision of Dr. Sarah Sadavoy. Welcome to Grad Chat, Seamus.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
See, that's a pretty good radio voice. We were just talking about radio voices, have what we need to do to sound like we know what we're talking about. And there you go. You got a good one there. So, astronomy. Why did you come to Queen's to do astronomy?
Well, I did my undergrad previously at Mount Allison University over in New Brunswick. Did that in general physics, but during my time there, I did my undergrad honors thesis in sort of theoretical astronomy, creating models, but that was focusing more on creating models of Jupiter-like planets to try to get better estimates as to what their Jupiter's core mass is.
Oh, it's a lot of math then.
Surprisingly, no, because because all the math was already done. You know, had software that I was using that was, you know, made already, so I was kind of just putting all the parameters into this modeling software, right, and analyzing what came out and kind of just seeing how the different physical parameters were changing based off the different inputs. So that's what I did in my undergrad that originally got me into astronomy. I wasn't originally going into astronomy when I went in my undergrad. Originally, I was thinking about, you know, particle physics, but the dice land where the dice land, and I got into astronomy in my undergrad, which led me into wanting to study more planet formation and trying to get to the small scale things that astronomy tends to study rather than the really, really large things like, you know, cosmology and galaxies. I wanted to study the really, really small bits of stuff where the really nitty gritty tends to happen. And that's what led me here to Queen's with working with Dr. Sadavoy. We are working in star formation, but we're working in the area of star formation that connects to the formation of planets.
Okay.
And so it was a really nice transition to go from sort of studying planets in our solar system and what their characteristics might be to kind of going a little bit back in time to figure out sort of the precursor to what forms these planets.
Which is not an easy fate, but have you always been interested in astronomy? Because whenever I think of astronomy, I think of a little kid with their first telescope looking up into the stars and things like that. Is that how you got interested in the field in the first place? To even think about doing it at undergrad?
Well, to be honest, no, not really. I did always like looking at the stars, and I always like sort of just reading books and sort of listening to people explain astronomy and this like cool stuff that you can just sit in awe and consider the gravity of the implications that go into these things just existing in our universe, well beyond our solar system, beyond our planet.
Right.
And like I said, you know, I went into undergrad not wanting to study the really big, far away stuff. I wanted to originally go in to study the really, really small, tiny subatomic particles.
Right.
But then, you know, interests change, you know, opportunities shift, and, you know, I happily fell into the cozy bed that is astronomy.
Which I think is pretty fascinating. I mean, and if Kingston doesn't know yet, the Kingston community, of course, began to have a solar eclipse here in Kingston on April the 8th, I think it is.
Yes.
And, of course, with Queen's, we've got our little observatory here, and I'm assuming that's going to be used as part of what we can do for some of the training that's going on, the teaching about what the solar eclipse is all about, in a safe way, of course, because we have to be careful. But this is so exciting for our community to have something that you normally wouldn't have in your own backyard for hundreds and hundreds of years. What do you think about it? Are you going to be part of that, one of those solar ambassadors, or what are they calling them?
Well, I'm sure I'll be roped into the volunteering event assistant progress on the day there. Like, I know there's a lot happening within the physics astronomy department already with trying to source all the material, the solar glasses, and just organizing events and activities throughout the city, so that way we can just accommodate the troves of people that we're expecting to come to Kingston to view the solar eclipse, because Kingston's in a very unique position, because when the solar eclipse does happen, will be in the path of totality. So this is when most, 99% of the sun will be blocked by the moon. You know, it's a
incredible,
very narrow path, and we're just lucky enough to be in that path this time around.
Yeah, because I was actually reading, I think it was the Gazette article or something, and there, you know, with this total solar eclipse, Earth is in a unique position, the way our moon is, or our distance from the sun, and where the size of the moon, and it all just lines up perfectly to make this, and not many other planets have this opportunity like we do.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting how the orbits of our moon and the sun and Earth all work out, because, you know, as you know, like, the moon is much, much, much smaller than the sun, but when you are viewing it at the distance that it's at, it appears almost about the same size as the sun, even though the moon is much closer than the sun is to Earth, but it is also smaller. So that kind of balancing act between being a distance away from the Earth, but also having a different size, makes that when the moon actually passes right over the sun, the moon blocks out nearly exactly the right amount of the sun to just
It's going to be very spooky.
It's going to be definitely spooky, but it's a brilliant opportunity for anybody who wants to study, say, the solar corona, because the moon doesn't block exactly.
Also, you still see some little things spiking out.
Yeah, you just see the edges.
Edges.
And when you block out all the rest and not the edges, you're able to study the corona, the edge space of the sun.
Little solar flares and all these little bits and pieces. So, Kingston, if you're not aware of it, you are aware of it now. And it's a phenomenon that you're only going to see once in your lifetime here in Kingston. So I'd suggest finding out a bit more. So go on to the Physics, Engineering, Physics and Astronomy Department's website, and it'll show you all about what to expect on that particular day. So thank you for giving us a bit more on that. Now, as a Trekkie fan myself, we still have a long way to go to understanding space, or the final frontier, as they say on Star Trek. As your research suggests, there is still a lot to learn about the formation of new stars. And with that, of course, your research topic is called Investigating Annular Rings in Young Protostellar Disks. Now, most of us will go, what the heck is he talking about there? So can you give us a bit of an overview of what that investigation tells? And then we can ask some more questions that will help alleviate that thought about what that title is.
So I think whenever I do explain my research to anybody, it's always nice to kind of just break down each of those little words in that title, because it's really hard to find a title that says everything that needs to be said, but it's also really hard to find very layman's terms to describe it.
So that's great for the academics, what you said.
Yeah, it's perfect for academics, perfect for conferences. Unfortunately, astronomy doesn't have very nice nomenclature that's easy for the general public to understand.
Not many academic things, no.
Yeah. So I find it's easier to kind of break those down into a few little bits. I'm studying protostellar disks.
Which is?
Proto simply meaning new or young.
Okay.
Stellar, star.
Stars.
And then studying the disks around these new / young stars. These stars are still in the earliest stages of their formation. They have not achieved the stage that our sun is at, where it's burning hydrogen into helium through nuclear fusion. It's still kind of accumulating mass and building up the heat and pressure in order to get to that point.
Can I ask one question before you go any further? When you talk about disks, are you talking like what you see around Saturn, that little layer outside the planet itself? or not?
Close to it. It's very similar, but on a much larger scale.
Okay.
So when these new stars form, they're forming from a collapse of a giant molecular cloud that's kind of just compressing in on itself.
Oh, okay.
And right. As this cloud compresses, it balls into its protostar. But as this protostar forms, since the cloud was rotating, this angular momentum is also being transferred down onto this newly forming protostar, causing that to spin as well.
Oh, okay. And because is it kind of like a whirlpool coming into the middle?
A little bit. If you ever took sort of introductory physics, like if you're rotating with your arms out in a spinning chair,
right.
You're going to rotate fairly slowly, but as soon as you tuck your arms in, you spin really
faster.
Closely. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and so that's also what's happening with this protostar. But also, as the material continues to fall into this protostar, it's also falling onto its equatorial plane. So just the equator of this newly forming star forming onto this equatorial plane with all the gas and dust that was originally comprising this molecular cloud. This disk of material around the equatorial plane is what we call the protostellar disk. This disk around this newly forming star.
Can I ask a question about a sun in general? Because a star is like a big sun. Is a sun, right?
Yes.
What we call a sun, yeah. Okay. Is the sun a solid mass or is it just a bunch of gases?
It's just a bunch of gases.
Okay.
In a very simplified way, it is a bunch of highly compressed gases that is just exploding constantly.
All the time. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's star, depending on its mass that it is, will either burn very, very quickly and very, very hot, or will burn very slowly and very coolly. It's a bit of a range spectrum where you have really, really small stars that burn very coolly and very slowly and therefore have a longer period of time.
Okay.
It's a bit of a...
What do you mean by longer period? Because, how many light years are we talking about? Is it measured in light years or is it...
So light years is a measure of distance.
Oh,
which
good
is,
point.
Which is very,
yes.
very...
Very different.
Yeah, very, very different. When you have years and then you obviously think, time, right? Years is time, but it's actually the time it takes light to travel in 1 year.
Right, yes, good point. So with our sun, for instance, clearly it's already been there for millions of years in our timeline.
Yeah, billions of years.
Billions of years.
Our sun is about halfway through its life. It's several billion years old.
And is ours considered a small or a slow one, a cold one?
Well, this might sound a little cocky and kind of, our sun's supremacy, but our sun is kind of middle of the ground, perfect center of stars.
Oh, that's
it
good.
Is approximately, the average size a sun can be and approximately the average temperature, suns typically get. So it's right in the middle, right in the sweet spot, because if it was any bigger, it would burn very, very hot and burn very, very fast, and Earth would never have formed because of that.
Okay.
But if it was very, very, if it was smaller, it would burn very slowly and at a lower temperature, and Earth would likely just be a frozen ball. Yeah.
Right. Oh, so that was lucky then that we got the good one.
Extremely lucky, depending on who you ask. Like, this is just perfect conditions for life, but of course, it's perfect because we formed, so
yes.
It's hard to consider if it was different whether life would form and whether that would be even more perfect.
So some of these new protostellar disks to form these new stars, how far away are you looking at them?
So
because stars are a long way away.
Yeah, so we are looking relatively close by. Mm-hmm. We are looking at a local star-forming cluster where it's just a cluster of gas and material that is just, in the process of forming stars at various stages of evolution.
And is this a new galaxy?
No, this is
still within our own galaxy.
Okay. So it's we're looking at around 132 parsecs away, which is about times that by like 3.2 light years.
Okay.
I'm not too sure what that is off the top of my head.
It's probably going to be a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely far enough away that we likely won't reach it in our lifetimes unless we have some kind of Star Trek first contact situation where we have Vulcans going down and they send us there. We're like, that's what it looks like.
We're going to find a wormhole.
So it's sufficiently far away that we likely won't get to it for a long time, but it's close enough that it's easy to see.
And how are you seeing that?
We are seeing this through a very nice, very nice and very big instrument called a interferometer telescope array.
So looking at infrared.
Yeah, we are looking in the infrared spectrum with this interferometer. And for those that don't know what an interferometer telescope array does, it's essentially just a collection of telescope antennas that, you know, are individually small, but when you collect them into a sort of a configuration where one is separated from the other by, you know, hundreds of meters, if not kilometers, you can get a artificially large collecting area of light without having to build a single really, really large dish.
And are these antennas on Earth or in space?
These are on Earth.
Okay.
Yeah, these antennas, this array that we're using is called ALMA. It's the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It is located in Chile, the Atacama Desert.
Okay.
In the desert where there's nothing around that could interfere, and
so
it's very dry air.
So no lights and things, yeah, which is important. But you're just using the data that's being collected, correct, from all of this, which is where it comes to modeling, which is not an easy thing to do, is to try and figure out the modeling of creating these new disks and new stars.
Right, yeah. So with the data that comes from ALMA, from this interferometry array, we're getting observations of these young protostellar disks at different wavelengths. So we're looking at them at different points in the infrared light spectrum.
Right.
And so that way we can see different views of each of these disks. We can see what the light is coming off of and how it differs between each wavelength. Reason why we're doing this is because the star, the disk itself, doesn't emit any light. The central star, the newly forming star, that is emitting heat and some light as well, and that gets scattered off of the dust that is comprising the disk. And that scattering emits at very specific wavelengths.
Okay.
And depending on the size of the dust, it emits at a different wavelength, which is why we're looking at multiple wavelengths, so we can look at essentially different sizes of dust.
You use the word dust, but you also use the word disks plural. Are the disks different? Like, do the disks have different particles within them that's going around?
Yeah, so all the disks, you know, are comprised of gases and dust, you know, interstellar dust, which requires immense amount of heat and pressure in order to create. We have a tough time just trying to create this kind of dust here on Earth. It's very hard to form here on Earth, but it's very easy to form in space during a star formation process. And so as the star forms, as this disk accumulates mass from its parent molecular cloud, it, you know, the dust coagulates and gets larger combining with each other, and, you know, eventually gets larger and larger in its cross section, and therefore it starts emitting different wavelengths of light as the light comes off of the central star and scatters off. And so by looking at the different wavelengths coming off of these disks, we're able to essentially see the light coming off of different sizes of dust. And so we're able to get a much clearer and detailed picture as to the makeup of these disks. Rather than just looking at one wavelength, which would mean that we're only looking at one specific size of dust, which is great. A lot of good research has been done doing that. But we want a more detailed picture so that way our models are even more accurate.
And the model is modeling what kind of star is going to be formed?
Not quite. Our modeling is modeling the disks itself. The star is important. The star will probably take, you know, a few more million years in order to get to a point like our sun.
Right.
But we want to see what the disk and what the star is currently. We're trying to just model its current conditions rather than try to map out into the future, which is still a pretty hard process. That's still something that we're trying to work on. You know, if you have input conditions, you know, we have the star disk right now, what that will eventually become. This is kind of trying to fill in one of those steps so that way we could do that in the future.
So can I just backtrack a little bit to make sure I've been listening correctly? You started off with some sort of cloud formation that was collapsing.
Right.
And then from that, you get these particles and dust and whatever else that are forming these protostellar disks.
Yes.
Okay, and then from that, eventually it'll make a star of whatever size, capacity, etc.
Exactly.
So with your modelling, it seems to me the most important part is to find whatever this cloud is first to see when that's collapsing. Do you need to find the cloud first before you can find the disks? Or can you, with your modelling, predict that another star is going to eventually form over there because we can see this cloud and eventually that's going to collapse?
So the clouds that I was speaking of, these giant molecular clouds, mm-hmm. you know, these are kind of just the parents. These are where all the material lies that eventually would form these stars and the, you know, associated protostellar disks around these stars. What my modeling is trying to do is kind of taking the observations from these telescope arrays, taking those observations and creating a model on those and trying to figure out best fit conditions, best fit parameters. So,
okay.
you know, how massive is the disk? How massive is the envelope of gas that's surrounding it? You know, how bright is the central star? You
right.
know, how large is the disk in terms of radii from the central star? Like, how far does it stretch out? You know, what kind of shape does it take on? And what
okay.
kind of rings does it have?
And if you work out that from this one that you're looking at, are you hoping to extrapolate that to others that you may find?
Yeah, it
is. And to see if it's similar or yes. depending on if how what parameters change, it'll make this sort instead of this sort.
So we are looking at two different disks right now. It's
okay.
it's a fairly small number when you think about just how much disks there are, but we have very good observations on two. And the goal of it is to think that we've seen rings around in these disks before, but these rings existed in much older disks.
Oh, okay.
These rings are essentially just at a certain radii, there is a ring of material that goes all around the disk itself,
mm-hmm.
and these rings have enhanced brightness. They give off a more light, and so they're punchier. They stand out
right.
in the observations. And ever since seeing these rings in observations of older disks, where it's much easier to see because there's no obscuring envelope of material that's still collapsing in onto the central star, we wanted to see when exactly do these rings form? Because if they're forming
mm-hmm.
at this later stage, do they form at an earlier stage?
Right.
And lo and behold, they do. They form much earlier in the process. And these rings have been often understood as being where planets tend to form.
Okay. So that's going to be critical then, isn't it, moving forward? But that's only two rings, you were saying.
Two disks, but we have three rings between the two of them. So one has two rings itself.
Right.
The other one has one ring.
And so with modeling and things, there's always variables which you have to take into consideration. So if you're only really seeing a couple really, really well, how do you know that some of the other things that are around aren't having an impact?
So that is one of the tricky parts. With our observations, we had to do a lot of sort of cleaning and calibrating to ensure that mm-hmm. we remove all that noise so that way what the data that we're getting in and feeding into the modeling is just the disks and
right.
the star, and we're not counting any sort of artifacts or any noise from the observation or any background objects, that we're just getting the disk itself to make it very sort of bright on the image. So
mm-hmm.
that way the modeling only cares about that. So that was a very time-consuming process to try to just calibrate, just me sitting in my office, be like, clicking away for days and days, just making sure that our signal to noise, just how bright the object, the disks are compared to the background mm-hmm. is as bright as it can be.
So what are you ultimately aiming to do? Because I'm a Master of Science is not long.
No.
So you do have limited time.
It is painfully short.
So what is your ultimate aim for what part you're playing in this?
So my ultimate aim is sort of to just lay some groundwork in the investigation of these rings, because these rings haven't been investigated in this great of detail before,
right.
because it requires a lot of computing time and just
yeah.
a lot of data to be fed into it in order to get a good detailed picture. So what my plan for this research is, we're modeling this disk with parameters that also modeled the rings itself. And, you know, this will help, like, when future astronomers look at these disks, they know where the rings are, how wide the rings are, but also how much denser these rings are compared to the rest of the disk.
Okay. So that's going to be really important then.
Yeah, the density is probably the most important bit because
that's what comes eventually together to create the star.
To create planets.
Planets.
To create planets. So we see this happening in older disks already, where we are seeing planets form within rings of older disks already. And why this is important, why having denser rings is important, is because that's one of the ways that planets tend to form. It's called core accretion, where dust particles, you know, collide with other dust particles to form larger ones, and they collide with other ones to form even larger blocks of material. And eventually that snowball effect, you know, continues for a few years, a few hundred thousand years at least.
Right.
And it forms a planetesimal or a planet's core and starts to draw in other material from the surrounding area thanks to its newfound gravity with all that mass.
I think I was getting myself confused of star and planet. So thank you for clarifying that again for me. So if this is, these disks are sort of planet forming, what happened to Pluto?
Pluto's always that source of contention within the community, and there's always people that, you know, feel bad for what happened to Pluto. And, and for those that don't know, you know, Pluto was originally characterized as a planet. And then a couple of years ago, I think at least 10, maybe 15 years ago now, Pluto was declassified as a planet. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons for this. I was not at all old enough to understand them at the time. But how I understand it now is that Pluto didn't form in the same way the rest of the planets formed. It didn't form the same way as Earth, as Mars, as Jupiter, or Neptune did. It formed in a different way, in a completely different area of space. Because as we know from these disks, is that planets all form within these disks.
Mm-hmm.
And this disk is on the equatorial plane.
So it's on one plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why we see all the planets from Mercury up till Neptune being roughly on the same plane as well.
Good point.
Pluto is way above this plane, and it's about 30-ish degrees off the plane. So there's no way that it could have formed along with all the other planets unless some calamity in the early solar system just knocked it out.
Yeah.
But that's unlikely because Pluto is very, very far out in the outer reaches of the solar system. So it's very, very cold out there, making Pluto to not be consistent of, you know, molten rock or gas like, you know, say Earth or Jupiter is, but it's a good chunk of it is consisting of just ice. So with it being off the plane of the ecliptic, we know that it likely didn't form with all the other planets. And if it starts moving closer into the solar system, it's going to heat up and all that ice is going to evaporate and it's going to lose a bunch of its mass. Similar to how comets do as they come in closer to the sun from the outer solar system, they form that tail. That is just all the ice kind of melting off of it.
Okay.
And so if Pluto did the same thing, Pluto would not be nearly
not be
as big
same.
As it is right now. And it's already very small.
I've learned lots today. So I really appreciate that. I mean, that's why I think, you know, space is still fascinating because there is still so much to do. And it's actually very tricky, isn't it? Are you hoping... After this, I mean, your master's, like I said, is very short. Are you hoping to continue this work and do a PhD or go off into a totally different tangent?
We will see. I'm not entirely sure where things will land come September is when I anticipate to be finished my master's. But it will be nice to see, you know, if I don't continue this research, it'll be nice to see other researchers pick this up and continue on with it, because it's really quite interesting to see what we're seeing is the earliest stages of star and planet formation.
And I think you have done a great job, like you said, of giving that background so no one else has to spend the hours that you've had to spend trying to sift through and get rid of all that noise, as you call it.
Just to give some context on this is that, you know, we have two disks at different parameters, different positions, but one of them is very inclined relative to us. It's inclined at 72-ish degrees. So we're seeing it close to edge on.
Right.
But our modeling takes into account what's called radio transfer, which is the propagation or transfer of energy from the central star mm-hmm. into each particle, dust particle that's making up these disks. Wow. And when you have it highly inclined, you need to do a lot more work in order to find these transfer of energy, make its way out to you, because it has to go through that really thick layer of material, because it needs to go from the center all the way out. And if you're looking at it edge on, it has to go all the way out through the entire thing. So it takes a long time. And with a computer at like 52 CPUs running around the clock, it takes several weeks to get a best fit model finished for it.
It really is quite remarkable of what we've managed to do, not me, but you and your colleagues have managed to do, to really see what's going on out there, knowing how far away it is from us, and knowing that these antennas, for instance, as you said, are actually here on planet Earth down in Chile.
Yeah.
It really is remarkable of how you're managing to filter out so much of this. So I take my hat off to you and your colleagues for plugging away at it to give us a better idea of how stars and planets and everything else that's going on up there.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I obviously can't take all the credit. A lot of groundwork has been laid before, and my supervisor, Dr. Satterfoy, has just done a remarkable job with getting everything ready for me to come in and just play with all of this stuff.
You're just playing.
I'm playing with data, and I'm just seeing what comes out of it. It's honestly just fun playing with big expensive telescopes. Half a world away. I'm just taking their data and be like, thanks, and I'm just plugging away on my computer, having fun with it.
And then finding that one little thing that you said, I need to get rid of that.
Yeah, just got to find that one little thing. That's largely what master's thesis end up being. It's you're going very, very detailed on one mm-hmm. very tiny thing, but it's a tiny thing that has very big implications
yes.
for our understanding of star and planet formation in the future.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show to explain that, because like I said, at the beginning, I think I was getting myself a bit confused between planets and stars and, what bit's working in these disks. So I really appreciate that. And with all the new things that are going on up in space, it's fascinating.
There is a lot of stuff going on.
I'm going to look at that solar eclipse and total solar eclipse in a totally new vein now as well. So thank you again, Seamus, for coming on the show. And good luck with the rest of it. And be good to see when you defend in hopefully the end of the year.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, Colette.
You're very welcome. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ, signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.